The Commerce Department reported yesterday that the U.S. trade deficit broke a monthly record to reach $43.1 billion in January. Analysts say the trade imbalance is caused in part by higher oil prices, by a continued flood of imports from China, and aggravated by a slump in exports to Europe. There was a time back in the 1980s when the words trade deficit made the front pages. Well, we haven't seen that much for a while, but it seems to be back in the news today. $43.1 billion, though. What exactly does that mean? Is it bad? And if so, how bad is it? Or is it something we've lived through and can survive again? If you have questions about how the nation's trade balance works, join us by giving us a phone call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can email us, totn@npr.org. And here to help explain the trade deficit numbers and what difference it can or can't make in our lives is Mike Santoli, a senior editor at Barron's. He's with us from his office in Manhattan. And Mike, thanks for joining us again on Talk of the Nation.
Oh, we're glad to be here. Thanks.
There was a time in the not-so-distant past, those words again, trade deficit, that was a big, big concern. Are we returning to those days?
It seems like, at least in terms of the kind of public discussion, we are returning to those days. Back a while ago, it was Japan that was the purported villain. They were going to be kind of taking over many of our industries, so was the story. Now, obviously, it's more China and India, along with Japan still, which is still a net exporter to the United States. So I think in the popular discussion, yes, I mean, I think we're returning to that. But as we've shown, it was not exactly any kind of a fatal blow to our economy. Far from it. Back then, it probably isn't at current levels right now, but I do think that it's again kind of rising up, sort of representing some of the anxiety we have about our own economy here, and it's for that reason taking on more prominence.
Well, tell us a little bit about that number that the Commerce reported, Department reported yesterday. $43.1 billion. That's
yeah.
A lot.
It's a lot. I mean, if you annualize that, it comes to about $500 billion. In goods and services that we're buying in excess of what we're exporting. That's really what it means. Now, if you look at it in the context of the size of the U.S. economy, which is over $11 trillion at an annual rate in gross domestic product, so it's less than 5% of our total output is represented by net imports, basically what we're taking in more than we're selling to others. There's actually a way to put a positive spin on it, which is that our economy remains one of the faster growing developed economies in the country, in the world rather.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, we're buying more because we have more internal demand for goods than others do. In fact, the reason that Europe, for example, has been a poor source of exports recently for us is simply that those economies remain mired in virtually no growth, and also the recent decline in the dollar versus the euro currency has actually made our exports more attractive over there, but the economies over there just are not receptive to it. They don't have the demand.
Here's an email question we got. It's my understanding that products and services produced by U.S. companies abroad are considered U.S.-made, and therefore when they're brought back into the U.S., they are not considered imports because a U.S.-based company made them. Is that right?
I'm not sure that is right, actually. I don't know that there's – I don't know the strict rules on that, but depending on – the setup, if there's a multinational company that has an affiliate overseas that supplies goods for the manufacture of products over here, I do believe that might be considered an import. So it's not a clear-cut distinction always, whether it be a U.S. domicile company that happens to produce overseas. But let's keep in mind, it's not a very important part of multinational business producing things overseas and bringing them here. It's much more of a big deal that multinational companies here put a plant overseas to make things for the local market. That's something that's probably not that well understood. General Electric more likely will be making things overseas because they're going to deliver things overseas. Same with Coca-Cola. That's not, you know, 100% the case, but that's much more the case than creating a factory overseas to bring things here to sell to us.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is Steve, who's with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi.
I've heard a lot of comments about how both the trade imbalance and federal deficits really don't matter. Federal deficits hasn't led to an increase in interest rates and such. But what about the long-term effects?
Yeah. Well, I would never say that they don't matter. Certainly at some level, they're going to matter. And it is true that at this moment, the federal deficit, for example, has not seemed to spur an increase in interest rates over here. Interestingly, those things are kind of related because one of the aspects of this foreign trade story here is obviously China exporting lots of goods to us. The Chinese and Japanese central banks are also buying a lot of dollars, and they're buying a lot of United States Treasury bonds, which have the effect of reducing interest rates in this country. And the reason, part of the reason they're buying those dollars in Treasury securities is so that we can kind of keep rates low over here and continue to be a viable market for their goods. So in an odd way, there's a symbiotic relationship between the trade deficit and low interest rates over here. Now, that can't necessarily go on forever. Perhaps we reach a point when it will all of a sudden break and foreign creditors decide, no, we're not going to buy any more of those Treasury securities. We're not going to help you finance your deficit, and therefore interest rates would presumably go higher. For now, though, I think what the case that can be made right now is that it hasn't yet caused those detrimental effects. It's hard to say exactly what that threshold is, though.
Yet, and Steve, thanks very much for the call. Yet, at the same time, the dollar has been going down in relation to the euro, which normally would make American products cheaper, and there would be a surge in exports to Europe, and that's, it doesn't seem to have happened.
No, it certainly hasn't. And again, it seems that the, first of all, there's some kind of a lag effect there. I mean, there's not a day-to-day kind of fine-tuning of demand in Europe for American goods based on the currencies. But over time, that should be the case. I mean, and on a relative basis, we would hope it would eventually be the case, except that those economies over there are very export-oriented. And so it's arguable that when European exports are less attractive to the rest of the world, their economies are hit hard enough that the demand in Europe for all goods, not just American-made goods, goes down enough that it doesn't really create enough demand to offset the negative impact here. So it's, unfortunately, it doesn't seem as if the United States can export its way out of this issue.
Now, when you talk about essentially China and Japan as well, less so recently, but those two countries buying up U.S. Treasury notes to prop up the dollar and thereby keep interest rates low, in a sense, you say it's like China lending us money to go on a buying spree.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, it's some people have actually been glib about it and say that, you know, the Asian economies are acting as a retailer that's letting us buy on credit, and in fact letting us buy on very cheap credit for the moment. So because it's almost at the moment, at least, in everybody's interest to have this situation persist for a while. The Chinese have hundreds of millions of people in kind of underutilized labor they need to put to work. To do that, they feel they obviously need to be a net exporter to the biggest economy in the world. The Japanese economy has had a deficit of internal domestic demand for goods for a decade and more now, and they also feel they need to be a net exporter. So you have this situation where almost every other economy is attempting to export its way out of its own problems. The United States, by default, by the biggest economy and the one with the strongest demand levels, is the kind of the source of all that demand that they're looking for.
We're speaking with Mike Santoli. He's a senior editor at Barron's. He's speaking with us from his office in Manhattan, trying to explain us a little bit about the record deficit in trade reported yesterday by the Commerce Department. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And this is Eddie, and Eddie's on the line with us from Chico, California.
Hi.
Hi.
One of the things that I keep hearing is we hear about these trade deficits and we hear about these losses of jobs overseas. Is the demand for the products here in America that are produced cheaply overseas not actually fueling both of those things? I mean, don't the two have to be related at least on some level? In other words, if we as consumers were more willing to purchase products made at home, would that not only cut down on the trade deficit, but also sort of address that issue with manufacturing jobs going away?
I think on a limited basis, you might be right there. But, you know, it's not so easy to decide what's made here and what's made abroad. Walmart, for example, is by far the biggest single importer of goods from China. They imported, I believe, last year anywhere from $15 to $20 billion worth of products that they funnel through their stores. You'd be hard-pressed to walk through a Walmart and know exactly which products were sourced overseas in China. And I think that one thing to keep in mind is that, one, the number of manufacturing jobs and the percentage of manufacturing jobs in the country has been going down since 1950. I mean, it seems to be the sort of maturation of the U.S. economy and the additional productivity of it that has kind of contributed to that very, very long-term trend. You know, another thing to keep in mind is, as long as we continue to have the benefits of cheaper goods over here that are sourced overseas, it actually does end up being a net benefit to the overall economy. Obviously, it's a net detriment to anybody who's kind of caught in that transition and loses a job over here, and any of the regions of the country that are particularly hard hit by that. But the way the mathematics of the economics works, you know, one of the reasons we've been able to kind of keep to under 6% unemployment and been able to kind of keep consumer demand rising for every quarter since the early 90s, you know, is that the economy has adapted and has helped us to get lower cost goods from overseas. So I know it doesn't really help in terms of, it doesn't make anybody feel any better, it doesn't make anybody feel that good jobs are being created here at a faster pace, but it probably would be a futile effort to try and stand in front of that that overall trend right now.
Eddie,
right,
thank you.
And a follow-up, if I may.
If you keep it quick.
Sure. Just to make sure I understand, this loss of production jobs trend in the U.S. has been going on for approximately 50 years.
Manufacturing jobs.
To lay that squarely at the feet of the Bush administration would be not only wrong, but basically laying blame as opposed to possibly looking at ways to fix a problem?
Well, I think it's a long-term secular trend. There's no way to get around the fact that it's been going on for a long time, whether there's been things done to accelerate or to stanch the trend or not in the last few years. It's arguable. Or whether there's been jobs produced here to kind of take up the slack is also arguable. But no, I don't think that it's anything that's happened in the last few years.
Eddie, all thanks right. very much.
Thank you.
And let's see if we can get Irene on the line. Irene is with us from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, I'm a wedding and portrait photographer, and about 2.5 years ago, I saw my business drop off appreciably, and I have, I'm still waiting for it to recover. When I hear all these cheery forecasts that the economy is starting to boom and that the trade deficit doesn't really matter, I wonder, when is all this good stuff going to hit me?
I obviously can't say specifically, you know, when it would hit you. And I mean, keep in mind that when people talk about the overall economy growing, that can be, it can be very lumpy. In other words, certain parts of the economy can boom and bring the overall numbers up, while other parts obviously, you know, struggle. And I think that there's always this kind of ebb and flow of what's in favor and what's growing and what's not growing. So it has generally been the manufacturing and export sides of things that have been struggling most. The things that have been growing have been things like, you know, healthcare providers and even on some level government workers have not been hit quite as hard. But there's actually, unfortunately, no easy answer for when exactly it kind of comes down to kind of pull everybody up.
And regional.
When we talk about unemployment figures, does that also take into account people who are underemployed?
No, the straight unemployment rate does not take that into account. In fact, it only takes into account those folks who say they are looking for work and have not been able to find it. There's another alternative unemployment rate, which takes into account those workers that have either stopped looking for work or are working part-time when they would like to work full-time. That rate is above 9%, closer to 10% most likely.
Irene, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And thanks very much to our guest, Mike Santoli, a senior editor at Barron's. He was with us from his office in Manhattan. Appreciate your time today, Mike.
Thank you very much.
And be sure to stay tuned to NPR News today for continuing developments on the story breaking out of Madrid, Spain. 190 people are dead in 10 bomb explosions earlier today at a train station and in trains in Madrid. There are now two lines of investigation. The Spanish government initially suspected ETA, the Basque separatist group, but now there is also a line of investigation after a van was discovered outside of Madrid with detonators inside and a tape with Quranic verses on it. Details on those stories coming up later today on NPR News. Ira Flatow is here tomorrow with Science Friday. We'll see you Monday. I'm Neil Conan, NPR News in Washington.